Let's resume. What I want to do is start going through part one and then part two of the code generation notes. Now, we're going to have in there is a lot of utility routines, which will make generating code a lot easier. So we'll certainly have visit methods. This is for the class code generating, which will actually generate code for one particular kind of node or another. But there'll be a lot of utility routines also, so that as you look at the visit nodes, one of the things you'll be impressed by, I think, is how succinct they are. Because a lot of the harder work is done in little utility routines that we write once and use as needed. So what we're going to do then is we're going to create essentially a class code generating that has knowledge about a particular file. So in this case, we're calling the print stream that we're using ASM file for assembly file. You could change the name, but it doesn't really necessary. And what's going to happen is in the notes, when I say generate this or generate that, that is really just an abbreviation for call a routine. You might call it generate. That is going to do a print to ASM file of a particular string that represents the contents of one line to be generated. In some cases, it'll be a simple operation code, so-called opcode, or it might be something as simple as a label declaration. In other cases, it may be more complex. So looking back at the example I had previously, in some cases, the line was amazingly simple. Like there was one that was just I add. It says generate an addition from the top two operands on the stack. In other cases, it was fairly long because I was doing a method call and I had to put the name of a particular path to a Java class. Doesn't matter. We're just going to do a series of prints. So each time I say generate, that simply means in your code, do a call to something you might call generate or gen or something that has the effect of doing a print to this ASM file of the appropriate contents. How do you know if you're generating properly or not? Well, at the end of your test, look at the file generated and see if the instructions coming out are of the form that you're expecting. If so, fine. Otherwise, there's a minor error that needs to be fixed. Now, to make this all work, we're going to have to add one more piece of central information. In Project 4, we did type in kind. Now we're going to add yet a third piece of information. This will go in symbol table entries and also into AST nodes for anything that's an expression or below an expression in the hierarchy. So a simple way to keep this clear is if you added a type and kind field at a particular place in Project 4, now you're going to add something that represents essentially an addressing mode. And what did we call those? We called them adder mode, as we'll see in the next things. So think of this as an enumeration, if you're used to using enumeration a la Java. Failing that, just think of these as constants of a particular type, like integer, that have symbolic names that are easy to read. So what will happen is each time we have a value, I'm going to have to remember where it is I'll find it, if it's a variable, an expression, whatever. And the options are global. Global means that it's stored essentially in a field in the class, and it's accessed via a label. Or it might be local. That means it's local inside of a method, and hence it's inside of a frame indexed by a particular number starting at 0. I can have stack, which means that it doesn't have a home anywhere but on the stack. Typically, as an expression is being computed, it sits on the stack. I could say it's a literal, which means I know particularly what the value is as a number or as a string or as a character, and I have access to it, or none is used as an initializer. Say I don't have any information yet. So going ahead, that means we'll have the field address mode is the type, adder is the name of the field. That is one of those fields I just showed you. So we'll actually have a field called adder that we'll use from time to time. And moreover, depending on the setting of adder, we'll have some auxiliary information. Again, this can be put in the AST node and in the symbol table node that says, hey, if the adder value is global, that means I access it by a string. What string? Here it is. It's called label, and it'll be set as we generate code to the appropriate string value. Typically for a field, it's the field's name slightly mangled, and I'll explain why in a little bit. If it's a local, it'll be this integer index starting at 0. So you're the zeroth variable, or the first, or the second, or so on, inside the frame. If you're literal, and an integer or a character or a Boolean, I'll simply store an integer value, represent your encoding. If you're a string, I'll actually have the string value in quoted form as returned by the scanner way back when in Project 2. And if it's a stack, we don't have any auxiliary information. It's on the stack. There it is. Go and use it. And if it's none, that means there's no addressing information needed. That's an initial value, or it can sometimes be used if we have a type of void, where void doesn't return anything. What's its address? None, because it's void. Again, that's just, we'll reference this from time to time. Okay, let's get into our very first, but certainly not our last, code generation utility. So this is a routine we'll call from time to time whenever we need to load an integer. Now, I call it load I because way back in my history, there was actually a machine that had a load I opcode that I remembered. But I stands for integer. If you prefer, you can change it to load int or load integer. Do that uniformly. But it's a routine I'll call whenever I want to load an integer. Where do you imagine I'm going to load the integer? Onto the stack. So it's going to take a parameter called val. And again, you could call value or something. Val is good enough for me. And here's the thing I warned you about. When it says generate a load of an integer literal, what you have to do is print into that file, the ASM file, the actual opcode, the actual letters LDC. And since val is a parameter, you'll actually print out the number that was the integer parameter. So it might be that says, please load the integer 7 on the stack. You'd call load int of the parameter 7, and it would generate a line LDC 7. It says to the assembler, please put on the stack the integer literal 7, and it knows how to do that. So we'll use this a lot, but whenever we need to put an integer on the stack, this is how we'll do it. We'll call load int, and it will have the effect of generating the appropriate low-level instruction, the LDC. So LDC is one of those things that is sometimes hard to remember. Load constant. If you know it, you know it. If you don't, you don't. But load int or load integer is a little bit more human-friendly. Okay, well, we don't always load just literals. Sometimes we have to load a variable that's static, that is, represents a field. How do I do that? Well, I call load global int. Global because it's a global as compared with the local, int because it's of type int. It takes a string because globals are fields, and fields are indexed by their field name. So it says, what I want you to generate is the line get static, that comes out exactly as such. What is class? Well, I set up above, class is going to be a shared variable of type string whose current value is the name of the class you're compiling. So in my earlier example, it was class simple. Whatever it is, you get it from the AST node at the root and say this particular shared variable called class will have the actual class name I'm compiling. So class here becomes whatever name you're compiling. You actually print the slash. Name is a parameter of type string, so you print out the actual string that name represents. And space I says you're loading an integer, you're loading in this case a static variable. I says it's of type int. I can also load a local int, and what happens there is I generate an I load that says an integer load, and in this case it takes a numeric index. Says this is the zeroth or the first or the second or whatever it is, local variable in the current frame. So this is used for local variables inside of a method. And guess what? We're almost to the point where we can generate an interesting operation, namely a binary op. Add, subtract, multiply, divide, a wide variety of them. And guess what we do? All we have to do is generate the op code that pertains to it. We already know that integer add is I add. I believe integer subtraction is I sub. Integer mult is I mul, M-U-L. Integer divide is I div. And again, we can look that up for you. It's not top secret, but you'll have to figure that out. For some of the others, it's a little less obvious. You know, what are we going to do for an and operation, a Boolean and or a Boolean or? Or later on, we'll talk about how you do comparisons, like is something less than something else or something greater than something else. But basically, you set up the parameters on the stack and you generate an operation as a single opcode with no other parameters. Why? Because the other parameters are already sitting on the stack and the operation knows how many parameters it takes. most operations are binary, so you do add, subtract, multiply, divide with two values. If you're doing something that was unary, like a not, it would have one operation, one operand on the stack. If we did loads, we also have to have store, so let's look at those. We have a store global that again takes a string, and what it does is take the value currently sitting on the stack and puts it away into a field. So put static is a JVM operate code. Class is the real class you have. Slash is a slash. Name is the parameter. So it says into class slash name, put the value currently sitting on top of the stack, treat it as static. That is, there's one location throughout the life of the class. I could also have a local, in which case I do an iStore, I for integer, store for store, and I print out the index that represents which local it is in the current frame. So now we can all of a sudden get down to actual code generation for actual AST nodes. So whenever we have a visit, this is the guy that will actually be executed when we're visiting a node for code generation purposes. So code generating has a series of visits, one for each of the kind of AST nodes. And what we're doing here is figuring out what code generation we want. Obviously, I'm starting out with easier ones, but we'll get to more involved ones. So for example, how do I translate an integer literal node? Well, first of all, what do I mean that for it to do? And what I want it to do is put that value on the stack. So when I see an integer literal, it's going to be used. If it's going to be used, it's got to be on the stack. So I put it on the stack. How do I do that? Well, in this particular case, I do a load I that has the effect of putting the integer value int val on the stack. And in case I want to do some later optimization, I set the addressing mode to literal. What I'm doing here is you may or may not actually need that, but I'm setting up some future optimization possibilities. Let me tell you about one of those because it's something which pertains, and you may or may not have thought about it. And that is, sometimes our code generator can do things which looks awfully simple-minded, and it is. The job of our code generator is to generate correct code, not necessarily always the most lovely code. So that means that, for example, I have a code generation say, please do 1 plus 2 as an expression. What our code generator is going to do is essentially do a load constant of 1, a load constant of 2, and an I add. And that's perfectly correct. But what, as an alternative, could the compiler have done instead if it was, for example, more advanced or more complex, or it was subject to some extra credit? It could have gone ahead and said, hey, when I'm doing an operation like plus, and both of my operands are literals, I don't have to generate code. I can figure out at compile time, rather than as the program executes, what that operation must be equal to. So as an optimization, I could say, when we get around to doing binary ops, it would say, okay, I'm doing plus, for instance. And say, let's go ahead and process, let's look at these two operands and see if the first operand is an int literal node, I know its value. If the second operand is an int literal node, I know its value. So if I visit those nodes, it's going to put those values on the stack. But if I kind of just peek and say, are you a literal, an integer literal? He says, yes, and yes. I can say, well, what I'll do is I'll never visit these guys at all. Rather than generate this code, I'll change this to a 3 and generate essentially load constant 3. And that's as a way of saying, rather than evaluate a simple operation like addition, all of whose parameters are constants, I can substitute the known result and use that instead. Now, I'm not doing that, but I'm simply saying that's why I'm making some notes about why things are necessarily literals or not. So I might say, having done this, this guy is a literal, and that might be usable in some other context. So in this particular case, the takeaway, let me go back to this, is that the key operation is the load I. The way we really translate a load, an int lit, is load its value on the stack. And by the way, if we want to set up some future optimization, I can remember that. If you're not going to do that optimization, don't even bother with that line. Otherwise, it won't be needed. It's something to saying, yes, indeed, where is this value? It's a literal, so it's on the stack, but it's also literally available, so I don't even need to put it on the stack. In this case, I visited the node and put it on the stack, but I could have avoided that if I did this optimization I showed you. Similarly, let's see, how do we handle character nodes? Well, remember, a character is something we've translated to its numeric equivalent. So in this particular case, I load an integer of the character value, store it as a number, and in this case, again, the address is a literal, and its value, if I want to remember it, is a char value. The key takeaway is, how do I translate a character, put its numeric code on the stack? The other two, again, are just setting up optimizations, which you may or may not need to do. Since I've already given it to you, you can put it in there, and if you never use it, you never use it. If you do need it, it's sitting there just in case. Hey, here's a few more. Hey, we're knocking these things off left, right, and center. How do I translate a true node? That's a Boolean constant, but we know true is routinely represented as 1. So I say, please push the literal value 1 onto the stack. Call load I, and I remember that it's a literal and 1 if needed. False is represented as 0, so load integer of the value 0, and it's a literal with the value 0. So literals are pretty easy, essentially just pushing them on the stack, and somebody else will store them or manipulate them. But that's good. I mean, these are final values, and now you've got 3 or 4 nodes that are final in terms of their code generation effect. Something a little bit more complex is a name node. In fact, name node is going to go through a couple of variations. So I'm going to start out with a simple one that's incomplete and later on expand it into a more complete one. Name nodes are fairly complex because names represent variables of various types. So I have to cover all my contingencies. So I say, okay, name node, this is something you did for type checking. I'm going to do it for code generation. All right, is the subscript value null? If so, this means it's a simple value, not a subscripted indexed array. Starting out with, we won't worry about arrays yet. We will a little bit later. So we say, okay, this is a simple identifier. It could be a global or a local. So it says, okay, what's your kind? Well, we're not doing parameters yet. So if you're a local, I'm sorry, in this case, if you're an identifier, you could be a variable or a value. If that's a particular case, then you're a scalar variable or a constant. I now go ahead and say, well, how do I figure out if this guy is global or local? Well, what happens is, if it's global, I'm going to store information in the symbol table entry that it's global and its label. If it's a local, I'm going to save information that it's local and what its index is. I'll do that when we process declarations, which we'll do a little later. But how do I get at that information? This is really important, and make a note of this and double check. I have this particular link called ID info. And what that is, and I warned you about that when we were doing type checking, that's a backward link from an identifier to the symbol table entry we found when we looked it up. And I warned you, you want to keep that link, because when you did type checking, you checked if the identifier was a type integer or char or Boolean. Now I want to also go back and say, well, what address and what mode did you associate with it? We'll fill that in the symbol table entry, and the ID info says, I can go back and find that symbol table entry, which now has addressing information, and get that information. So now I can tell if an identifier, once I know that it's a scalar, is a global or a local, by just going to its symbol table entry and seeing what address information I stored. Now, we haven't seen that yet, but when we process global declarations, which we'll do soon, and local declarations, which we'll do when we do methods, that information will be filled in. Remember that before I ever generate code for expressions, I have to have processed all the field declarations, all the local method declarations, so that code will already have been executed. I'm not showing it yet, but it'll be executed in the order that is presented to the user. Presented by the user, and not necessarily in the order in which I'm explaining things. So at any rate, I have the ability to say, if you happen to be a global, what I want you to do is execute a load global int. So here's a way, if I see a name that's a global integer, I load it. Otherwise, if you're a local, I do a load local int, and there it is. This part about arrays we'll handle later, and indexing we'll handle later. So this is a subset of name nodes that will handle scalars. And there it is. And notice this is pretty much in nearly final form. So in a lot of these cases, you can almost do a cut and paste. And if you go ahead and do so, that's fine. Notice you may need to declare some variables. I don't have declarations always complete. And you may need to do some fairly minor things like typecasting or something. But basically, the code there is the code you should be executing, and there are no flaws that I know of. I haven't put any booby traps in or anything. Essentially, this thing should work. I've simplified it a bit just to make it easier to read, but it is valid, and it should give you a big hand up in terms of getting your logic straight. What I was really worried about, the reason I did this, is code generation is one of those things that if you forget about one thing and you get deep into the project, you say, oh my gosh, I forgot that arrays could be indexed. You have to go ahead and undo stuff. And undoing stuff is really bad because when you undo stuff, maybe you undo too much or too little or so on. So I want to make sure that your design is sound to begin with, and then you simply implement it as designed. We'll have a little utility routine that says each opcode in the AST has a corresponding JVM opcode, and I'll give you a few of them. So I add, I subtract. You'll have to expand that as you add operators to say, what operation am I going to use for this particular binary op or some others. Remember, you have the arithmetics. You also have a couple of Boolean, and you also have some relational. The relational we'll get to soon. The Boolean turn out to be not too bad. There's and or, and it turns out there are, in fact, and or operations available in the JVM. Oh, hey, here, all of a sudden, what I warned you about earlier is coming to true. Here's binary op node. That's a pretty complex, a pretty frequently used operation, and yet translating it is very simple. How do I translate a binary op node? I first visit the left operand and the right operand for code generation purposes. That means the left operand will be dropped onto the stack, then the right operand will be dropped onto the stack, either by doing a load constant or a load, or maybe even by some computation. But when I'm done, since it's a binary op, I know two things have been pushed on the stack. I then say, okay, depending on what the operation code is in this AST node, choose the associated JVM instruction, like an IADD or an ISUB, and generate it. And bingo, that's all. Load the operand, generate the, execute the opcode, and you've translated a binary op node. So now you can do expressions, binary expressions. As long as you fill in the opcodes for all the various types, you're golden. And that's not a trivial sort of operation. A computation is something you do all the time. So now that I know how to do computations, I'm leading myself up to be able to do something like A gets B plus C. I already know how to do B plus C, load B, load C, generate an IADD. Now I have the value sitting on the stack. How do I do the assignment? So let's do assignment statements. Well, first of all, we're going to have to remember something that you may or may not remember from elementary programming, but I want to remind you of, and let's go back here. Here's something that's very important for code generation. If I have something like A gets A plus 1, in programming, those two A's that I've underlined don't mean the same thing. We're going to explain why, and then we're going to explain how it is the code generator differentiates. Now, we're so used to writing something like this, we tend to forget that they have different meanings. So the meaning on the right of A, the one I've underlined, the second one, what does that mean in terms of plain English? It says, get the value in memory that A has. So that's essentially a load. But the A on the left is not a load. It says, take the value you've computed, A plus 1, and store it into memory. This is the reason why something like A equals 1 and 1 equals A are not at all equivalent. In fact, 1 is so bad, it's illegal, and we already kicked it out of the pantheon of valid statements. So A gets 1 says, take the memory location associated with A and put 1 into it. But A on the left-hand side is not valid. Why? Well, in our language, in virtually every language, except going back to earliest languages, you're not allowed to actually use a memory address directly in your program. The reason for it is you don't know what memory location the compiler wants to use, what value the compiler wants to put in memory location 1. So if I said put it in memory location 1, it's probably not going to do any good and may do a great deal of harm. This is kind of similar to in languages like C, where you can actually get an address of something and use the address directly. So it turns out this is not allowed. But that means in code generation, visiting A on the left-hand side of an assignment and A on the right-hand of assignment mean different things. We already know what the A on the right-hand side means. It means figure out what A is, a global or a local, get the value associated with it by doing a load, and put it on the stack. The A on the left doesn't mean the same thing, so I'm going to treat it differently. And the way I'm going to treat it differently is I'm going to have a location, a different method called compute address. And remember, address kind of makes sense because we use addresses for stores, and the A on the left-hand side is going to be the target of a store. So it says, let's go ahead, and I'll give you a name node, and it says, let's compute the address associated with the name node. I have in bold, and, oops, sorry, let me go back. I have in bold, don't load the value onto the stack. I don't want to visit A and load A's current value on the stack if it's the left-hand side. I'm going to sit back a distance and say, I'm going to compute the address associated with A and use that for storage purposes. So how do I do that? Well, I'm going to go ahead and say, okay, name, are you subscripted or not? For the time being, we're not going to worry about indexing into arrays, so we're going to assume the answer is no. So the subscript value is null, so it's not subscripted. I'm going to go back to the name of that variable and check its ID info and say, are you a variable? If it is, you're a scalar variable, and I'm going to say, are you global? If you're global, then I'm going to have the address be global, and the address of the label is going to be whatever is associated with that variable. So what I'm doing is I'm putting in the name node the fact that it's, in this case, a global and a label associated with it. I'm not going to use that yet, but I'm computing the address. Turns out if it's a local, I'm going to actually put in the name node's information, the fact that it is a local and it has this particular address. And otherwise, we're going to handle the arrays later and subscripted later. So the takeaway here is that I'm going to look at the node and say, what address do I want associated with you, and store that in the name node. Notice I know that because I'm storing in the name nodes, label field or address field, global or local, and either a label as a string or a local as an actual integer. So I'm looking them up from the symbol table and storing them into the node. I have a similar one for identifiers. Occasionally we have to store into an identifier that's not a name node. Remember we had this problem that name nodes have an identifier, but they also have a potential subscript. There are a couple of places where I have a name node that cannot be an identifier that cannot be subscripted. And an example of that is int a equals 1. We're going to have to handle that. And is that a declaration or is that an assignment? Answer is both. So this has to be handled as a translation of a declaration, but I also have to potentially generate code to put one into a memory location. But notice I cannot, if I'm having a declaration, say something like int a sub 2 equals 1. That's not allowed in our language. It's not allowed in Java. It's not allowed in most programming languages. The reason for it is I'm declaring integer variables. If I wanted to declare an array, I declare an array and initialize the particular components later. So this notation is not allowed in our language. Therefore, the identifier used here is not a name node, because if it's a name node, I would have to worry about a subscript. It's an identifier. So that's why that exists. And what happens here, if I have a store identifier, it's essentially the same as above it. It's going to go ahead for the identifier and say, are you a local or a global? Store that mode. And do you have a label or do you have an offset in the frame? And store that. And the question is, why am I storing it? Well, we're about to get to that. Now we have a routine called store into a name node. So something we've already set up. And it says, again, we're assuming that the subscript value is null at this stage. If you're an unscripted subscripted identifier, if you're scalar, then it's var. In applicator case, if you're global, we use the label, and if you're local, we use the index and generate a store local or store global integer. That's that utility routine I defined earlier. And the takeaway on this is, look at how simple an assignment statement is, just a very few lines. What do I do to compute an assignment? I first look at the left-hand side and say, I'm going to get your address, either a local or a global. I'm then going to visit the right-hand side and evaluate it onto the stack. And then using the value on the stack and using the name address information I have already done a couple of lines above, I'm going to do a store name, which will store the value away. So these utility routines and that, we now have assignment for simple variables, including expressions. So now we have the code available that I could actually generate code for A equals B plus C minus 3, for example. I would go ahead and evaluate this, get the address of that guy, it's either global or local, evaluate onto the stack, and store it into a field using a label, or store it into a local variable using an offset. So we now have something about handling operands and handling assignments, which is pretty good. Any questions so far? So notice the flavor of this is we have some utility rooms routines to set up some of the basic operations, and then we try to make the visit fairly simple by calling these utility routines for the essential steps. I think this way it's a lot easier to understand, and if you have problems, rather easier to debug. So I did things a little bit out of order because I pretended I knew something about global variables, but I haven't handled global declarations yet. So let's go ahead and do that. First little bit, here's a gotcha that really might have gotten you, or maybe not. It turns out that Jasmine has this odd little restriction, and it says you may not have a label in a Java class that has the same name as a JVM opcode. That means for reasons that I don't fully understand, you may not have a field named LDC because there's an opcode named LDC and there's another one called IAD. So these are kind of oddballs, so the chances that a user might actually use one of those is slim. But remember, there's a big difference between slim and none. You know that whenever Powerball's out there, right? Everybody's telling you you have, you know, your chances of winning Powerball when it's a big hit is like 100 times worse or better, depending on how you look at it, than getting hit by a lightning bolt on the golf course. So you're buying the Powerball, says, I got a chance to win, and you're on the golf course, you say, well, the chances of me being hit by that lightning there is very, very slim, so I'll try to sneak around in whether or not I should or not. So you always kind of convince yourself one way or the other. What are the chances that a user really would use LDC or IAD? Very slim, I think. But why don't we protect ourselves? And here's how we're going to do it. We're going to do a tiny bit of name angling that says each and every field that a user declares is going to have a dollar sign appended to the end. It turns out that in Jasmine, you may use a dollar sign as part of an identifier. In CSX, you can't, so it would never be used by a user. So we're going to say, here's your name, and we're going to put a dollar sign, and that guarantees that there's no chance at all that field names will trip and match identically an opcode. Now again, in most cases, you really don't need the dollar sign, but we're going to do it just to protect ourselves. And as you're reading the code, it actually helps a little bit because you say, okay, if I see a dollar sign, that means this thing is being used as a name of a field. And that might help jog your memory if you're trying to figure out what the code is doing. So we're going to do that little bit of name mangling just to keep Jasmine happy. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and handle field declarations. Remember, field declarations may have an initializer, so we have to worry about that. So we're going to say, is the, let me go backwards. When you declare a field, we're going to declare its name and type. And for trivial initializers like 0 or 1, you can actually plug in the literal value into the declaration. If you have a non-trivial initializer, so let me switch mode. Oh, I still have it on there. So if I had, for example, something like int a equals 1, I can actually have the initializer of 1 included in the declaration. But if I have a more complex declaration, so int b equals 2 times a plus 1, And notice this is legal. I'm allowed to, in an initializer, use fields that have already been declared. So whatever A was, I want to double it and add one. This is going to have to generate a little code. And I want to distinguish between those two. So here's how we're going to do it. What will happen is I'll first simply say, is the initializer a numeric literal? In most cases, that's likely to be the case. So I'm going to say if the initializer is an integer literal, a char literal, a true or a false. Those are all simple ones where I don't need to generate any extra code. And I'm going to recognize that. If I have something that's more complex, this test is going to fail. Remember, instance of says, are you this particular class or that particular class or so on? So I'm saying, is the expression node that's being used as the initializer a trivial one, like a literal, or something more complex, like a calculation? So I can distinguish between those two. Moreover, if it is a trivial literal, I'll go ahead and go into those nodes and extract the numeric value. So these guys go together. If you're trivial, give me your trivial value. And all of a sudden now, the declaration of a global integer is pretty simple. In this particular case, I take the string I want, and I take the initializer, and the initializer, notice, may not even exist. It may be null. So in this case, I check and say, is this thing a trivial initializer? If so, I'm going to generate the following. Dot field, public static, name comes in as a parameter, I is the type code, equal, and the numeric value is the numeric value that I got by examining the initializer. Otherwise, I simply go down there and generate the same line without the initializer. So if I simply say int A, I don't have an initializer, and I generate that bottom line. Well, we're going to, at some point, need to declare arrays. So how do we handle arrays? Arrays have a special type code of left bracket and then their component type. So if I have an array, its type code is going to be bracket A, bracket C, or bracket Z. Remember, Z is be used for Boolean. And when I need a type code for an array, those are the choices that I need, and I have a little method that'll give that to me so I don't have to remember them. I just program it up and say, okay, give me the correct type code, please. And now I can declare a global array. I say dot field, public, static, the name is the parameter, and from the type of the array, I get the array type code and plug that in. So now I can declare an array. Well, remember, arrays have to be allocated via a new. So we have to actually generate code to say, give me an actual Java object that represents that array. And how do I do that? I call allocate array. So it says in this particular case, give me a new array of type int, a new array of type char, a new array of type boolean. How do I know how big it is? Well, as we'll see in a moment, I'm going to push the size of the array, which is always an integer literal, onto the stack to say how big the array is going to be. We're also going to need routines to store global references. Arrays will generate a reference. So it turns out the way I store a global array is put static, class name, and the array type code. For a local, I use not an I store, but an A store. A stands for reference, and I don't know why they don't use R, but they don't. So an A store stores a reference into a particular location. And now I have a way to declare a field in this particular case. I go ahead and take the name and mangle it by adding in a dollar sign. I go ahead and declare the global int and store information about its label and the fact that it's global. And I can declare a field for a const almost the same way. I munge the name, take the value in this particular case, and make it available as a constant and store that as a global and with the appropriate label. And here's the array I talked about. I get its name by mangling the dollar sign. I go ahead and I declare the global array. I get the array label and store it as a global. And finally, here we go. We actually have the code generator for of our Deckel node using all those utility routines I talked about. So I say, is the current method null? What's the current method stuff? What does anybody remember what we use that for?
To track the method
I'm in. And 99% of the time you're in a method, but one time when you're not in the method is when you're processing fields at the class level. Fields are not in any method. So one way I can say, am I a global field or not, is by saying, is my current method null? If it's null, I'm not sitting in a method. Therefore, this declaration is not of a local. If it's not a local, it has to be a global and therefore a field. So I say, if the method is null, that's my tricky way of finding out that this is a global field declaration. If I don't have any ID information about it, I'm going to go ahead and declare the field. That means I have to go ahead and set up information. Otherwise, I do a second pass if I have non-trivial initialization and saying, if the initializer is null and it's the initializer is not a numeric literal, I actually visit the initializer and store it. So in the case where I have a non-trivial initialization, I declare it in one pass and then I initialize it on the other. And we'll handle locals later. How do we handle constants? Almost exactly the same as ordinary variables. The only difference is in the type checker, you may not change a constant. So in this particular case, if it's a global field, a global constant, I should say, in this particular case, I just simply declare it. If it turns out that I'm doing the second pass and I have a non-trivial initialization, I then go ahead and compute that initialization and store it into the constant's location. And finally, we get around to array Deckel nodes. I know how to declare variables that are global fields. Now I know how to handle arrays that are globals. So again, we're just doing global arrays, not right now. So I say if the current method is null, then I'm doing a global. If the ID adder information is none, that means it's first pass. So I declare the field. Otherwise, we'll handle the initialization later. And then what I do is I actually generate some code. So I declared an array, and now I got to actually create it. So I load in the size of the array. I call allocate array and then store the value as a global into the label associated with the array. So this is saying essentially when I declare an array, I have an invisible initialization. The invisible initialization is create the array and store a reference to the array space in the global field you've just declared. Arrays have to be initialized by doing this creation. Otherwise, I'd be trying to access space that doesn't exist. And bingo, we've survived code generation notes part one. Any questions about this? I'm just saying to yourself, my gosh, this is a ton of detail. And yes, it is, but it's also a case where the way I recommend doing this is taking each of the little routines one by one, reading through it and kind of putting in your head what it is that it does. And then going to the visits and saying, okay, they call these various routines and that puts together the whole translation. So start with simple ones like assignments and expressions and make sure you can handle those. You can borrow a lot of the code from CSX Lite. And what we'll do next is get into something which is a tad more involved, namely some I/O and some conditionals. So let me get out of this guy and find the other. So this is the one I handed out today. So switch over, and now you're on the second set of notes. And the first thing we'll do is I/O statements. Turns out I/O is not as bad as you might fear, because a lot of the work is actually done in CSX Live. So what we're going to do here is we're going to do both reads and writes. So this is the first time we're going to actually have to generate a call to a method. In this case, there'll be library methods. So we're going to have a routine that we use a lot called generate a call. This can be a call to a user routine or to a library routine. and it's parameterized by a method descriptor. What's a method descriptor? Well, it's essentially the thing I showed you earlier. It's the name of the method with the parameter information included and the result type encoded as the very last character. It puts the character last because if it put it first, you'd get confused between the name of the method and the type returned. So in this case, it puts it at the end after the closed paren, where there's no ambiguity about what it might represent. So in this case, we're going to have a little routine that generates a call. All we do is say, here's the path name that I want you to call, class.method or package.class.method or whatever it might be. And let's take a look at these. Hey, this is not bad. This is a visit. Now remember, the cool thing about visits is this is the final step. Once you've got the visit done for an AST node, you are done with that AST node as far as code generation is concerned. So if you're doing things where you're knocking off one node and another, once you process the visit and know how to do it, that part's done. And presumably you get down until almost all the methods are handled and whatever's left you do, and at that stage you're code generating for the complete language. So how do we do a read node? What we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, there's only really a couple of things we can read because our language is limited, integers or chars. As I reminded you, if you want extra credit, you can simply go in here, add some new things to the CSX Lib. The CSX Lib, I got the source form for it as well as the translation, so you can read that and modify it or extend it or, you know, just use it as a basis. But if you wanted to be able to read things other than integers and chars as extra credit, here's the spot where you would do it. You'd essentially end up just putting in a call in to yet a different library routine, something that reads not just chars or integers, but something more complex. For example, you could have something that reads strings. How do you read strings? Well, there's a couple of ways of doing it. One is have the user put in quotes, and then you can have embedded blanks, or you can have a sort of an intermediate thing where the user doesn't have any embedded blanks, and you simply keep reading characters until you hit a blank or an end of line. Which is kind of like a scanner, and kind of a mini scanner, and you could have something that reads a string, and therefore you wouldn't have to read character by character. You could read an entire string. You might even have some sort of game where you put underscores in and then translate those underscores to blanks so you could actually read a string with embedded blanks. So if your name is Tom Jones, the user would type T-O-M underscore Jones with the understanding that the underscore turns into a blank. And hopefully the user doesn't want to translate, enter real underscores or not. Maybe you'd have to escape underscores or some crazy thing. But I mean, there's some games you could play to make the language more user-friendly if you cared to. Let's just stick with the basics, and I think the rest, the extension, would be pretty easy. So remember, what a read is essentially an implicit assignment. The name in the read list is a target of an assignment. You get the value by calling the library to read something from the keyboard. It gets onto the stack, and then you store it just like an assignment. So here's our old buddy compute address again. It says this particular name is going to be an assignment. So go ahead and compute the address associated with it. That is, look up whether it is global or local. If it's a global, give me its label. If it's a local, give me its index so I know where to store the value. So compute adder is exactly the same for assignments and reads, which is one of the reasons why I made it a little utility routine so you could have one definition and use it in a multitude of places. So, okay, so we compute the address. Then it says, let's call the library routine. How do I figure out which one to do? Well, in this case, I only have two choices. So, in this case, it's either an integer, in which case I call CSXLib of readInt, or it's a character, I call CSXLib of readChar. Well, wait a minute, what if the user is trying to read something that was not in this list? Suppose the user is trying to read a Boolean. What would happen? Well, it would get past the parsing, but it wouldn't get past the type checking. So what I'm really pointing out is we're utilizing the fact we've done the previous steps. There are certain bad things that can't happen and get to this stage. So maybe the user tried to do some bad things, but they got stopped by maybe parsing, maybe by type checking. But if they got here, the only two things they can read, because you are enforcing it in Project 4, is you can only read character variables or integer variables. If you want to extend it, obviously you'd have to change your type checker a little bit to be consistent. So if you wanted to be able to read strings, your type checker would have to allow that opportunity to happen. I guess you really wouldn't be reading strings. You'd probably be reading character arrays or something, but whichever you decide. Maybe it was strings, whatever. So in this particular case, you get those two choices and you simply generate a call. And then finally, at near the bottom, I generate a store name. Store name says, take this particular name, target variable in this case. It already has its address information made available. The value I wanted is on the stack because I called the method. And please store it away into that particular variable. So I called the read, the value's on the stack, and now I'm storing it into an integer variable or a character variable. And then, since I can have a list of reads, I simply visit the more reads, which is another node, or in this particular case, I guess if more reads is null, I'm done. There's a case where you might have to check if it's null or not and terminate it that way. I'm not sure what visit will do on a null node. It'd probably be okay. It would just execute the null code generation, which is nothing at all. So mark this one is that this may need changing or not. I'm not sure. I think it still may work, so you're probably okay. Well, in this particular case, we're getting back to, remember, array type code, so we have to have those available again. We have to be able to load a global reference. Why is that? Well, I'm going to be able to print strings. We were talking earlier about reading strings, but I can print strings, so I load a global reference. Not a global int, but a global reference. The difference being that it loads a reference value rather than an integer. I'll warn you, if you try to make errors in this sort, the Java Virtual Machine is very strict about intermixing types. If you push a reference and treat it like an integer, it's going to be mucho unhappy. If you push an integer and try to treat it like a reference, it's going to be really, really unhappy, because these are ways that hackers break into systems. They break the type code. You can imagine you saying, well, please treat this thing as an address, and you put in a number. And this number could be the address of a very important local variable that you're trying to get a hold of, like maybe somebody's password. So Java is very careful about the fact references are created by new and the Java runtime system, and you cannot cast an integer into a reference or a reference into an integer. That's important. In C and C++, you can, and that causes a multitude of dangers. That's why C programs oftentimes are easy to break into, because the type checking is pretty weak. So in this particular case, that's why we need a different routine for references, because it's going to generate slightly different code and keep track of that information. Load a local reference. In this case, it's an A load instead of an I load, but it's essentially the same otherwise. And now what's going to happen is I'm going to extend visit of a name node a bit. Remember, we had an earlier version in here to have some more options. So in this case, it's a situation where I'm still not going to handle a subscripted array, but now I can handle scalars that are of type val, var, or scalar parameter. So I'm starting to set those up. And I can also handle, toward the middle, something that's arrays. So now it's the case I can handle arrays, and I want to have that because I want to be able to print a character array, for example. So what I've done is extend name node. This is version 2. And stuff in the middle is new, and essentially includes the ability to handle arrays. We're still not handling subscript expressions yet. That'll come later. Okay, so now let's do some more visits. How do I handle a string lit node? I essentially just do a load constant of the string in quoted form, and that'll cause the actual Java system to create a string, initialize the appropriate value, and put a reference to it on the stack. That's the thing we used in that example of a bit ago. So now we're going to do print node. I'm sorry, the print came on one line. The line break was unfortunate, but this is part of the next page. So in this particular case, I'm going to compute a value and print it on the stack. So how do I compute the value? I go ahead and visit the output value and force it to be pushed on the stack. So in this particular case, it might be a character array, it might be a string, or it might be a scalar that's an integer, boolean, or char. So now I start doing some checking. I say, is your kind an array parms? Well, in that particular array or array parms, in this case, you must be printing a character array, and I generate a call to a routine that prints a character array. So the notion here is I had a program that filled in a character array, character by character by character, and I'm printing it. And this is my crude way of manipulating strings or creating string-like variables. If it's not an array, I say, are your kinds string? Remember that string had String literals had this thing that their kind was string and their type was char. So if the kind is string, then we're going to go ahead and do a print string. Otherwise, you're a scalar, and I'm going to check the type, and integer does a print ints, boolean does a print bool, and character does a print char. And then I go down, and if I have more prints, I continue doing a print for remaining operands on the print list. So if you look at it, doing prints is really not all that bad. It simply checks the special cases and the types and chooses which library routine needs to be done. So any questions on that? Okay, now we're going to really start getting into some interesting constructs. And here, by the way, if you're thinking about doing extra credit for for loops, this ties right in. So I'm going to talk about how to do code generation for while loops. And then for loops are simply an extension of while loops that have an initializer and also have an increment. So it's a while loop is the body. So you know how it is in a for loop. For I gets one while some loop condition is true, here's my initializer, like I plus plus or something. So let's start with while loops, which our language does have. And it turns out the design, as I show right here, this is the actual design for all while loops. Now we're going to have to be careful here because we're going to have to make sure that we can nest loops. It's not obvious yet that loops nest properly, but they will. So here's the form we're going to use for all while loops. We're going to have two labels. These labels will be created uniquely so that if I have multiple loops, I won't use L1 and L2 all the time because I want these to be unique. I'll have some little generator says, give me a brand new label. So it's sort of a situation like here. Some programs do a password generator. And I know my program, whenever I type a password, it says, I don't like that password. Why don't you try this one? It gives me the most god-awful password you ever imagined. It's about 13 letters and has symbols, and I never, ever, ever remember it, but it still suggests it. So we're going to do a similar thing. We're going to have unique labels, but they're not going to be awful. They're going to be pretty reasonable looking. So here's how all for loops are going to execute. They're going to have a label up top that precedes the control expression. So the control expression is going to evaluate a Boolean. What does that mean? It's going to go ahead and put a 0 or a 1 on the stack, depending on true or false. I'm then going to execute a conditional branch. I haven't showed you those yet, but now we need one. And it says if equal. Now, what is it equal to? Well, in this case, if it's equal to 0. So if the top stack entry is equal to 0, I'm going to go to L2. Because L2, if it's 0, that's false. If the while loop's control executes the false, that means get out of the loop. So how do I get out of the loop? I go to L2, which is at the very bottom of the loop, and takes me to the remaining instructions past the loop. Otherwise, if it's not 0, it's 1. And in this case, we keep going. So we'll execute the body for the for loop, I'm sorry, the while loop, and then go back to L1, reevaluate the conditional, conditionally branch out, or continue executing. And essentially, that's all the code we'll have to generate. It turns out it's going to be very simple. But we have to handle this business about labels, because if we have multiple labels, I can't use L1 and L2 all the time. So what we're going to do is go ahead and have some routines that will go ahead and generate unique labels. We'll also, by the way, going to store label L1 and L2 as top label and bottom label, and I can store that in a symbol table entry for a CSX level label if I have a break or continue. So this is kind of cool. If inside that code I see a break, what that really means, break means break me out of the loop. How do I break out of the loop? Real easy, I go to L2. That gets me out of the loop. So all a break has to do is remember what label is associated with the bottom of the loop. Suppose I have a continue. Continue says stop this iteration, but try to do the next iteration. Continue with the iteration. Well, that's essentially go to L1. So breaks and continues are essentially a go-to to one of those two labels, and all I have to do is remember, associated with the CSX level label, the user-defined, what the top and bottom are. So what we'll do is top and bottom labels, as they're created, will be stored in the symbol entry for the label, if there is a label. If there isn't a label, you can't do a break or continue, and therefore it's not necessary to save them. So that's what that is about, and it's going to make break and continue unbelievably easy. Well, here I'm going to have some kind of generator. So I'm going to have a static integer. Static integer means it doesn't get reset. It starts at 1 and keeps getting iterated throughout the life of, in this case, the code generation process. So I'm going to start it at 1. I guess I could start at zero, but I'm just one of these humans. I hate counting at starting at zero. I always like count 1, 2, 3, 4. So we're going to start counting at one. If computers have really totally destroyed your mind and you like counting at zero, just change the initializer to zero. That'll be fine too. So generate lab for label simply goes ahead. Oops, let me finish my thought in. So what generate label does is all labels in our language begin with L. It'll generate a new number by incrementing that. Well, it generates the number and then post increments it. So we start with label L1, L2, L3, and so on. Notice I hadn't put a dollar sign on it like I did for fields. Why haven't I done that? Well, I did a little homework and I looked at all the opcodes that the JVM has. And guess what? Not one of those opcodes begin with an L and ends with a number. So there's no way my labels can ever conflict with a JVM opcode. And I'm choosing the labels. So in this case, I don't need the dollar sign. In this case, just the format, I think, guarantees it. But what I'm going to do here, as you'll see shortly, is generate a new label. Now, this stage, I haven't actually placed it in the program yet. I've just created it. So it's like, you know, going to a new job and say, I need a new email address. What email address is available? So first you get the address and decide if you can stand it or not, and then they put it in the system. So let me just take one more minute. So I have this other routine, and people sometimes get confused. Generate says, just give me a new name, but don't use it yet. Define actually says, go and in the program, generate the string that's a label. And if you have paper next to you, circle that colon, because that colon has to be generated. That's how the Jasmine recognizes this as a label. So it'd be the label you created, L1, L2, L3, colon. And the colon says this is a label definition. So it's important that be defined and it's easy to miss. So put a little mark or something just to remind yourself. So we had the little tinkling going on there. So let's take about 10 minutes and we have a final half hour and we should finish up most, if not all, of this number two and be halfway through code generation, which is pretty good.